try dropping the frequency a few knots. I'm hearing some distortion here.
Good evening.
My name is Chris Titan, and I'm here with Ray Carney. Our guests tonight are Wu and Brendan Simpson. We're going to be discussing the neo-psychedelic movement and touching on some very basics of bulbetterology. Welcome.
Hey.
So, Wu, what exactly is this neo-psychedelic movement? I hear you have three different avenues of perusal.
Yeah, it's neopsychedelic.com or neo-psychedelic.com or just neo the neo-psychedelicmovement.com. But the idea is that neo-psychedelic means the new mind manifesting, if you will. So a neo-psychedelic movement would be a movement within the new mind, and to me the new mind is made up of all us people being conscious neurons in a social network. So as we exchange information, then we are creating a meta mind, if you will, and this is a place to chart the effects of the meta mind.
Interesting. So neo is new mind instead of sort of a new psychedelic movement. That seems pretty crucial.
Right. It's the new mind, the movement of the new mind. So it's very rigidly defined by what the words themselves mean, which is somewhat pedantic, but that's where I'm starting from.
What sort of information do you have available at this time?
Nothing. This is a place for people to add stuff.
Okay. What sort of avenues should a person who's interested in maybe contributing, what should they maybe think about in their minds to prepare themselves, or what sort of projects are you sort of looking for?
Well, we all know who Keelati is, so I would ask her to send out an invite.
Okay.
So she should be able to send out an invite. Fenris23 probably can. I think Brendan might be able to. But just to ask, hey, it's a new blog for people to add whatever they want, because I'm just curious to see what gets added. That's the whole point of it, is to see what the social network manifests by working together.
And I don't know, why is this got importance to other people? What is propelling this?
Curiosity.
Why should people be, involved in this?
The curiosity. It's the same reason people buy books, you know, because what will happen right now, what I'm interested in is the Nine Inch Nails ARG, which I've been seeing things to and watching, and I'm really digging. And so, yeah, sure, it's marketing, but at the same time, they're doing marketing in a way I've never really seen done that well.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you think that on your neo-psychedelic blogs or on these blogs, we're going to have some information on this Nine Inch Nails ARG?
Actually, that's what I put up a few hours ago. I've been watching it all and looking at it all, so I just put up links a couple hours ago about the Nine Inch Nails ARG on neo-psychedelic.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. Are there any ARG communities who are really following that out and working for the hidden, like, Stego links and the stuff that's in the code that you know of?
Not that I know of, but I've been doing it myself and putting up the links. So all the links that I put up were from the source code of a page. So it would have been links that you would have missed if you had just looked at the page itself.
Okay.
And I've also noticed that, like, in the sound, in the music of the or in the audio releases, that there is definitely Morse code at the end of the audio files, and I haven't decoded it yet because I just haven't had time, but I know it's there. So.
Okay. Yeah, Morse code is one that's pretty popular.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Listening to it, you can hear the Morse code at the end of it. It's pretty obvious.
Yeah, because that's a pretty interesting idea they have. What is that chemical that's being added to the water?
Parapin?
Parapin, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I've been into, and that's what I've been following, and that's part of this, it fits into the idea of what a social network or a group mind would manifest is, puzzles and riddles.
Well, I think you're onto something. Just I found myself interesting is how Nine Inch Nails is using a pretty edgy ARG to promote their latest music. And that fits right into what, you know, what we've been trying to promote as ideas on how to get ideas out there. So,
yeah, it's pretty compelling.
What is interesting to see is how far they can take the reality of it. And
well, if you watch the television commercial and you pause the television commercial as the blue sign flashes past the screen, and you get it signed up, get it lined up just right, you'll be able to read that blue sign. And the blue sign says, "I want to believe." And if you go to iwanttobelieve.com, it's part of the ARG. So they're actually doing some stuff that's really, really compelling. It's at the same time, it's really cutting edge. It's they're attributing a lot more to their audience as far as the audience's intelligence than most commercials and most so they're actually aiming for smart people to play this ARG, which I think is nice. They're not dumbing down the message. How has the cult variety improved your life?
Well, let's see, the last nine, hosting the last nine episodes of the Culturati has been a real turn-on. What I didn't know when I started these Culturatis was that my nervous system was going to actually expand into the hemisphere and sort of merge in ways that I can't really describe.
You can't describe it. Did it really happen?
Well, the fact of the matter is that after about a point, after a certain point, language itself just became utterly useless, and I had to start communicating in, well, in boils and blisters. As he was about to descend, he heard a voice from a distance hallooing, "Rip Van Winkle! Rip Van Winkle!" He looked around. He could see nothing but a crow winging its solitary flight across the mountain. He thought his fancy must have deceived him, and turned again to descend, when he heard the same cry ring through the still evening air. "Rip Van Winkle! Rip Van Winkle!" At the same time, Wolf bristled up his back, and giving a low growl, skulked to his master's side, looking fearfully down into the glen. Rip now felt a vague apprehension stealing over him. He looked anxiously into the same direction and perceived a strange figure slowly toiling up the rocks and bending under the weight of something he carried on his back. He was surprised to see any human being in this lonely and unfrequented place, but supposing it to be some of the neighborhood in need of his assistance, he hastened down to yield it. On near approach, he was still more surprised at the singularity of the stranger's appearance. He was a short, square-built old fellow with thick, bushy hair and a grizzled beard. His dress was of the antique Dutch fashion, cloth jerkin strapped about the waist, several pairs of breeches, the outer one of ample volume, decorated with rows of buttons down the sides and bunches at the knees. He bore on his shoulders a stout keg that seemed full of liquor, and he made signs for Rip to approach and assist him with the load. Though rather sly and distrustful of his new acquaintance, Rip complied with his usual alacrity, and mutually relieving each other, they clambered up a narrow gully, apparently the dry bed of a mountain torrent. As they ascended, Rip every now and then heard a long rolling peals like distant thunder that seemed to issue out of a deep ravine, or rather cleft between lofty rocks, toward which their rugged path conducted. He paused for an instant, but supposing it to be the muttering of one of those transient thunder showers which often take the place in the mountain heights, he proceeded. Passing through the ravine, they came to a hollow, like a small amphitheater, surrounded by perpendicular precipices.
The Brunswick Shrine.
Over the brinks of which impending trees shot their branches, so that you only caught glimpses of the azure sky and the bright evening cloud. During the whole time, Rip and his companion had labored on in silence, for though the former marveled greatly what could be the object of carrying a keg of liquor up this wild mountain, yet there was something strange and incomprehensible about the unknown that inspired awe and checked familiarity. On entering the amphitheater, new objects of wonder presented themselves. On a level spot in the center was a company of odd-looking personages playing at ninepins. They were dressed in quaint, outlandish fashion. Some wore short doublets, others jerkins and with long knives in their belts, and most of them had enormous breeches of similar style with that of the guides. Their visages, too, were peculiar. One had a large head, broad face, and small, piggish eyes. The face of another seemed to consist entirely of nose that was surmounted by a white sugar loaf hat, set off with a little red cock's tail. They all had beards of various shapes and colors. There was one who seemed to be the commander. He was a stout old gentleman with a weather-beaten countenance. He wore a lace doublet, broad belt and hanger, high-crowned hat and feather, red stockings, and high-heeled shoes with roses in them. The whole group reminded Rip of the figures in the old Flemish painting in the parlor of Dominie van Schiak, the village parson, which had been brought over from Holland at the time of the settlement. What seemed particularly odd to Rip was that though these folks were evidently amusing themselves, yet they maintained the gravest faces, the most mysterious silence, and were withal the most melancholy party of pleasure he had ever witnessed. Nothing interrupted the stillness of the scene but the noise of the balls, which, whenever they rolled, echoed along the mountains like rumbles, peals of thunder. As Rip and his companions approached them, they suddenly desisted from their play and stared at him with such a fixed statue-like gaze, and such strange, uncouth, lackluster countenances, that his heart turned within him, and his knees smote together. His companion now emptied the contents of the keg into large flagons and made signs to him to wait upon the company. He obeyed with fear and trembling. They quaffed the liquor in profound silence and then returned to their game. By degrees, Rip's awe and apprehension subsided. He even ventured, when no eye was fixed upon him, to taste the beverage which he had found had much of the flavor of excellent Hollands. He was naturally a thirsty soul, and was soon tempted to repeat the draught. One taste provoked another, and he reiterated his visits to the flagon so often that at length his senses were overpowered. His eyes swam in his head. His head gradually declined, and he fell into a deep sleep. Well, the magicians of Bolbitterology in the story are fucking odd.
Are they?
Aren't they?
Well, they are the ghosts of Henry Hudson's crew.
Wow. Fucking A. I love the weird, melancholy, profound silence that they're keeping when they bowl, right? That's just spot on.
Well, they're maintaining focus and trying to remain tension-free.
Right, they're totally like tension-free. They're smooth, and it blows Rip away. And yet they have to sort of maintain the smoothness with this liquor that's just knocked him for a loop.
Yeah, well, they can handle it. He can't. That's the problem.
Yeah, and I'm sensing an awesome marketing possibility on this. If we can come out with our own special Bolbitterology, kegs, pony
so
kegs.
Tension, the alcohol makes you so smooth and tension-free that Rip Van Winkle can't handle it, so he falls asleep for 20 years.
Are you guys sensing the paranormal connections? Brendan Simpson apparently was contacted by the ghost of Henry Hudson in a similar manner to Rip Van Winkle some 100 years prior.
So you, golden sunglasses that allowed you to read, like, these long scrolls?
Wow, I actually do have a pair of golden sunglasses sitting right here.
You could take photos and get scrolls that you could interpret. Uh-huh.
Yes. Now, there's a similar thing where Brendan Simpson hasn't actually slept in 20 years. Now we're in bizarro world. Now, is it possible that one of the pins was stolen from Rip Van Winkle? And he was put into some kind of a trance and put to sleep.
That's interesting, because I've actually heard that very same theory. It was in a book written by, what was their name? Let's see. Samuel Kling, that's who it was. Samuel Kling wrote about that theory, and you may actually just be referencing that story, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Samuel Kling, in his book, the title was Marshal of the Heavens. In Marshal of the Heavens, he went on in great detail about the pin game that you're referring to. And at the very end of the book, in the last chapter, that is where he starts speculating and theorizing about the disappearance of the 10th pin, which may link back to your Kabbalistic theory.
Well, yeah, I think it was in Marshal of the Heavens that he discussed a very strange paradox. You might be familiar with it's not necessarily, it's the appearance of the 10th pin in bowling. So it's the disappearance and the appearance, something to do with the pin setter.
Oh, yes, that's right. The pin setters, up until recently at least, were actually young children. Maybe they didn't even go to school, they were just pin setters full time. But this was done manually and by hand, up until very, very recently when a machine was patented, and now all bowling alleys, 10-pin bowling alleys, are all maintained by machines. All the pins are set perfectly by these mechanical monstrosities. I might actually have the patent number written down somewhere.
So are you telling me that bowling is one of the first instances of a automatization by robotics?
I don't want to say it's the first instance specifically, but it is among the first mechanicalizations.
Oh, well, at least one of the most effective. I would really like people to be more aware of this, that when they are bowling, that this is an interaction engagement with the robot.
It is, yes. Absolutely.
Now, I'd like to bring this, because a lot of people aren't aware that some of the more subtle aspects that I've read in the manuscripts of the books that you've written that haven't been published yet. When we go into some of the deeper hypnotism, we sort of look at the autonomic nervous system as the robot. And I was wondering, you know, is it, if we're interfacing with the inner robot, and we're also interfacing with the pin setter, what is it that that mechanism that resets the pins inside our own internal nervous system? Is this something that I'm just seeing in bowl betterology, or is this something that's sort of intended in what you've been writing?
Bowl betterology teaches us that it's only through mind control that we are capable of achieving the constant and continued flow, the smoothness of motion. It's necessarily almost robotic, the way that you're saying it and the way that you're describing it. It is necessarily a great mechanical process, and you're trying to repeat the same process over and over and over again in order to achieve the same result, which is a strike, of course.
It's all about the 300.
It's all about the 300, absolutely.
Very interesting. Now, there is another, back to 300, since we get to numbers, a Kabbalistic conspiracy involving the number 300, 300 being the number of shin in the Hebrew alphabet, or the letter of spirit.
It's teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they say it's teeth, but actually it is it's pins. Now, the pins also can be taken to be the 10 teeth of the dragon. And there seems to be some mythology that's been emerging in some of the esoteric circles that I've been discussing this with, is that the bowling alley being the gaping maw of some dragon with 10 teeth. Now, there was a movie that recently came out about the pick of Satan. What's the name of that title of that movie?
So would each bowler then be St. George?
Absolutely. And again, there's St. George, but that's also a metaphor for St. Michael and Lucifer, which are engaged in this sort of circular dance. You know, they sort of need each other to push and pull as they engage in this constant sort of dance, which is the sort of constant dance that the bowler plays with the gaping maw of the dragon as he back and forth to keep the cycles. Because once you have to keep the cycles going, or you're no longer playing the game.
That's actually very advanced things, and I'm not sure that your listener base is fully cognizant of exactly how everything that you're talking about will relate back to bowling. To bowling better, of course, yes.
Yeah, was a movie. Gosh, what's the name of that movie? It's about a pick. The idea being that there is this pick that's actually the tooth of Satan. So one of the ideas is that the 9 pins and the 10th pins, when it was 9 pins, there was one of the pieces of the devil was missing, and it had been fully restored. So at this point, it is more a restored version of the the opposite force. Let's move on.
In your own time.
So, what I'd like to really look at tonight is the fact that we have a neo-psychedelic movement that's dealing with alternative reality. At the same time, we have a very reality-centered game such as bowling that's dealing with alternate reality. Mm-hmm. And we sort of have a blend here. Are you guys worried at all that people who participate in these things might actually lose their ability to distinguish between reality and alternate reality?
Reality is bowling.
I'm not concerned about that, because once you have begun to utilize the methods and techniques that have been taught to us by Jack Heiss and Al Rav, it helps you to unwind and unravel things so that things become clear. What is true and what is important, you focus on it. It melts away all of the tension in your life. It calms your mind so that when faced with the problems that you are bringing up, it just doesn't seem so important as all that, and it just becomes that much more clear when you have engaged in a
okay. I can see that being a very important point. Like everything on the esoteric path, you need to engage in some training.
Absolutely.
So if you just go willy nilly in the bowling alley, it's dangerous.
It can be. It can be very dangerous for you. If you haven't stretched right, if you have not had the adequate amount of alcohol in your system on, say, $1 beer night, for example, mm-hmm. then the patrons might become angry with you, and that will create a tense atmosphere. And really, all this is avoiding tension.
Right. Well, now that our listeners can smell the danger, where can they find out more about bowling better with Bowl Betterology?
At this very moment, there is one book out that is still in print that is being released by Melvin Powers' publishing company. It's called Wilshire Book Company. You can get it for $7. It's titled How You Can Bowl Better Using Self-Hypnosis. It was originally published in the early 60s, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, it includes contributions by the likes of Don Carter, Buzz Fazio, Thurm Gibson, Maryam and Joe Norris, who, as you may know, are all very high up, or were very high up, in the Brunswick advisory staff for Star Bowlers.
Okay. Now, I heard that there might be some kind of a special package being released sometime. Where can our listeners tune in to for news for that? Is there a MySpace?
There's a MySpace. It is myspace.com/bowlbetterology. That's BOWLBETTEROLOGY. Brenneco Media Group did recently acquire the rights to republish Al Rav's books, and we're going to be releasing a primer later this year in advance of that.
That sounds wonderful.
Happiness.
Well, bowling better does make you happier.
Happiness.
Well, I'd like to thank you guys for joining us tonight. It's been very informative.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah.
And again, Wes Unruh, would you give us the URL so we can tune in to more of this information on what's happening in the new mind of the neo-psychedelic movement?
Neopsychedelic.com should be just get you there just fine.
Okay. So we'll have you people bowling better with your new mind in no time. Just keep your hands inside the ride at all times.
Mind-blowing show, I'm sure. I'd like to thank both Alan Moore and Grant Morrison for joining us on our program, and I will speak to you again in 2 weeks. Good night, everyone. We'll be right back.